Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the FT Advisor podcast. I'm David Thorpe, Investment Editor at FT Advisor. Today we're discussing the question of what constitutes a defensive portfolio in the present time of high inflation, high market volatility and an uncertain interest rate environment. Our guests today are Ian Barnes, Chief Investment Officer at Netwealth, David Jain, Multi-Asset Fund Manager at Premier Miton, and Ben Guttridge, Director of the Model Portfolio Service at Invesco. Good morning and thank you all for joining me. David Jain from Premier Miton, given how volatile gilts and other government bonds have been in recent years, to your mind, do they still qualify as a defensive asset class? I know that one of the products you run has defensive or cautious in the name. Does that have gilts in it?
It's a very, very good question to start on, actually, David, because the belief that gilts or government bonds in general were low risk was always somewhat fallacious anyway. You were taking a huge amount of duration risk in bonds over the last 20 years. It just happened to work in your favour as long-term bond yields fell. And so investors thought, oh, these are very low risk and also very high returns. And it was a very naive point of view, but one that became very prevalent, hence the rise of the 60-40 sort of strategies. When thinking about low risk today, you really want to be thinking about low volatility, i.e. low duration in your bond portfolios. And actually there, you can, you know, if you're in short-dated gilts, you can get a yield pickup on cash. If you're in short-dated government bonds, you can get a further yield pickup. So there is tremendous opportunity in the bond market, probably more in corporates than governments, but if you sit at the short end.
And Ben Guttridge from Invesco, how do you think about the question of government bonds in portfolios right now?
Well, I mean, it is a pertinent question because these diversifying assets have just been so dreadful, haven't they? You know, equities have struggled, the bond market hasn't sort of bailed you out. But look, I think as far as government bonds are concerned, I still think they're a great hedge against growth disappointments. You know, we've seen bond yields move up, the acceleration in bond yields moving higher over sort of third quarter since the summer. And that's chimed actually with better than expected growth outcomes. So I think, you know, going forward, if growth is resilient and inflation remains elevated, then, you know, yields might move sort of sideways, bonds might be a bit pedestrian. But if you do get that growth shock, if you do get that recession at some stage in 2024, I would have thought long-dated government bonds are going to be a really useful asset in portfolios.
Thank you. Ian, I guess that was the challenge that multi-asset investors or portfolio constructors had in 2022. Bonds and equities moved in sort of the same downward direction. But indeed, even in the years prior to that, they moved in the same direction, but that was up, so nobody cared, right? But Where are we now? If they're going to be showing signs of correlation, are they defensive? Or if they're not going to show signs of correlation, to Ben's point, do they count as defensive?
Yeah, I think that there are certainly different environments when you can imagine that they're still going to provide some defensive support to a broader portfolio. I think you have to think about what the drivers of the volatility have been for bonds in the past couple of years. So certainly that uptick in inflation and the shock of whether we're moving into a new regime in terms of inflationary expectations. Once that has been sort of addressed by central banks, by lifting interest rates higher, the concern more recently has moved over into the levels of debt that are out there that are affecting the quality of all different types of government bonds. And I think the way that they behave in the future is going to depend slightly on what the growth profile is going to look like as we move out of the inflationary shock period and then think about what's next.
Thank you. And Ian, we'll stick with you for the next question. In that world of higher bond yields, even at the shorter end of the curve, what role, if any, do alternative assets play in portfolios? There definitely seem to be a range of alternative investment trusts, but alternatives generally, that became very popular in the era of low bond yields. But does one need alternatives if bonds and equities become inversely correlated again?
So I think you've got to be, again, quite careful of, as to what you're talking about with alternative assets, because it covers quite a wide range of different exposures. We've always stuck quite closely to a need for daily liquidity. And so if you're looking for alternatives that are trying to embed some form of illiquidity premium into their returns, then that becomes a bit more challenging. A lot of alternatives, I think people have discovered, have really just been a way of transforming a combination of illiquidity and sensitivity to rates. So they've been hit equally as difficult. So I think you need to think about what are the ultimately going to be the drivers of future returns.
Thank you. David, as Ian mentioned, there's, I guess, no standard definition of an alternative asset, but as a multi-asset investor, how do you think about them? And do you think they have a role to play if short-dated govies are offering us 5%?
I sort of broadly disagree with the concept of alternatives, actually. I think ultimately, there is an ownership of an asset, or there's a loan towards an asset, and there isn't really much else available in the market. So you're dealing with equities, property, and fixed income, and everything that's called alternative is typically one of those assets repackaged in a way to look attractive to marketing departments. And you know, like you said, you know, there may be an illiquidity premium, or it may sit at some extreme end of one of those asset classes and therefore not be recognisable as what it truly is. But generally, they're a lending vehicle or an ownership vehicle. And therefore, they will all be priced off that risk-free rate at the end of the day, be it the long bond or the short bond, whichever you want to pick. So I think, you know, buyer beware. You know, you're generally being subject to somebody's marketing strategy to make something look like something it isn't. And so we need to recognise that. And we need to recognise that ultimately all assets are priced off government bond yields, and government bond yields are, to a degree, a function of long-term nominal growth expectations. And so expecting some magic diversification benefit from owning something because it's been repackaged some way is not something I'm a great fan of. I think you should deal with reality and get on with it.
Thank you. And Ben, within the model portfolios at Invesco, is there a dedicated alternatives bucket? If so, what's in it? And what sort of allocations?
Well, we do have a dedicated alternatives bucket. what it's populated with, to echo sort of some of Ian's points, aren't necessarily the ones that we would ideally reach for, because we can't harness that illiquidity premium. I mean, you think about like what a great alternative asset at the moment would be like sort of private credit. You know, banks withdrawing from the economy, businesses getting more and more sort of starved of cash. The sort of rates you could command in the private credit space would be really, really interesting. But you can't deliver that in a model portfolio that's trying to deliver daily dealing. So you have to, I'm afraid, what you gain in liquidity, you sort of lose in alternative, less correlated returns. I mean, within the alternative space, it has been a disappointment because, you know, you're thinking about listed infrastructure, listed real estate, you know, high correlation to equity. So, you know, whilst the long-term diversification benefits are real, the short-term ones are not so obvious. I think also what you're looking at are, you know, sort of multi-strategy funds, but also like long-short equity funds. I mean, there, at least now, you know, they're buying some stock and selling some stock, so their net position is, you know, if they give them 100 quid, they'll buy 100 quid's worth of stock and they'll sell 100 quid's worth of stock. Their net position is they've still got 100 quid's worth of cash left over, so they can deposit that. And at least cash rates are giving them something of a tailwind relative to what hasn't been there in the past. So we still think they're useful in the context of optimal portfolios, but like recognise these, as both commentators have said, they're not quite as alternative as we would like.
Okay, thank you.
Can I add something? I was just thinking like something that David was saying was like when you're trying to add. So basically, we're all trying to find something that can add something different to the portfolios. And specifically with regards to defensive ones, it's pretty tricky because a lot of strategies are trying to repackage up different underlying exposures. The one thing that we felt has been pretty helpful was having a little bit of direct commodities exposure within portfolios, and even doing that at a small measure within the defensive strategy. An ETF based on commodity futures, a sort of basket of different commodity futures. Because the one thing that's going to threaten a portfolio that's sort of reliant on fixed income and a bit of equity exposure was that inflationary impulse. And so you try to think about what underlying exposures might benefit from that, and commodities have sort of played that role. But you have to be very careful about the sizing because they're obviously quite volatile instruments in their own right.
And is there a liquidity, an illiquidity premium with those, or is liquidity ample in those things?
It's not really a liquidity premium. I think you've got to be a little bit careful just because they don't deliver anything of their own accord. You're literally capturing a change in price, which is why it's hard to think of having a long-standing allocation in some cases, particularly when the funding rates are at 5%. But when you're thinking about what they can bring to the overall portfolio, they can do something different when other parts are struggling. And so I think that's what makes them attractive.
I think you've taken it in a very useful direction, actually, there. Because if you think about those low-risk clients right now, what are they trying to do? Minimize volatility, beat cash. Now, if we can own, say, short-dated corporate bonds and to pick up a credit risk premium on that, we can get sort of 6 or 7 quite comfortably without taking a lot of risk. But what is the risk going to be in that? The risk will be that rates push higher and we make a short-term capital loss on the bonds. We're still going to own that return to maturity. How can we hedge that? We can hedge that by owning inflation beneficiary assets such as commodities, such as equities, and net, if there is a strong economy, inflation persists, those equities will do well. We'll still earn the yield to maturity. In fact, we might do better in that environment. In the bearish environment, our commodities will be flat, equities flat, sideways. It's hard to believe equities could be flat to sideways for a further 3 years, but that would be the longest bear market in history. But the bonds will do tremendously well. So net, again, you're going to be beating cash from here. Whichever way you look at the economy, a well-constructed defensive portfolio is going to comfortably beat cash across all scenarios if you construct it well. As has been mentioned, inflation beneficiary assets to hedge your interest rate sensitive assets.
Thank you, David. You mentioned equities there. And Ben, if in a world where inflation stays persistently higher than the bank's 2% target, what does a cautious equity allocation look like? I say allocation as in that can be as a percentage of an overall multi-asset portfolio, or it can be the types of equities within the equity bucket.
Well, if we're for a more persistent inflationary environment, you want businesses that have pricing power. There are some challenges with that in the short term, in that, inflationary pressure can lead to more elevated bond yields. And there is this suggestion in the marketplace, certainly it can happen from time to time, that higher bond yields sort of punishes like higher quality businesses, such as sort of US equities, the loosely defined sort of tech sector. But personally, having looked at the data, I don't really see that stacks up. But so I would have thought higher quality businesses, where do we find the predominance of those? That's in the US market. So I would have thought in a higher inflation regime, it's US equities that would be the better long-term hedge against that outcome.
Thank you. And is it a case of, in that environment, valuation matters less and quality matters more, or resilience, quality of the business matters more, quality of the earnings and valuation less?
I think, valuation is important, but I would say that, the dominant piece is the quality of the business to be able to maintain its margins, deliver on its earnings. It's not for certain that a higher you know, a higher inflationary regime, you know, a higher interest rate regime, perhaps, you know, more debt servicing challenges for businesses, that more cyclical businesses like banks or whatever, that are one of the valuation trades would have a better time of it. But these are marginal calls. You know, I wouldn't sort of bang the table about it. You know, this is how we would sort of lean portfolios. I mean, there's certainly an environment where, you know, valuation, as we've seen in 22, could have a better time of it. But at the margin, I would be leaning into the quality and resilience of earnings in an inflationary environment rather than favouring valuation as a strategy.
Thank you. And Ian, how do you think about equity exposure at net wealth?
So we fundamentally start with sort of regional building blocks of and broadly using ETFs, clearly trying to understand what are the drivers of those different markets. So it's not always going to be the region that they're in, but the type of businesses that represent the index themselves. I think the difficult thing for everyone really is trying to think about what's going to be different about market behaviour in an environment where inflationary pressure is, you know, could be higher, certainly more volatile, and what's going to be the same as previous experience. And, you know, for the past 15 years, you've had US large cap equities beating everything else. Mm-hmm. And if we think about market pricing at the moment, it looks to me as though people think that rates are going to fall away, inflation's going to subside a bit, but earnings growth is still going to be, you know, reasonably strong. And that sort of taken together sort of screams lovely soft landing and everything's okay. But you've got to try and think about, you know, what could be different. And so I think that the question of quality, like what earnings can you rely on in the future, is going to be really interesting. So is a market that's pretty boring, like the FTSE 100, with, you know, high dividend yields, a bit of cyclicality from the underlying sort of corporate exposures. I think that's definitely got a role to play in a broader equity portfolio. And it feels to me as though the market sort of is taking that notion seriously at the moment. Like we get asked quite a lot about exposure to UK equities. They've performed broadly in line with the US over the past 3 years now, as you've gone through a transition of, you know, changing future expectations as people start to think about the relevance of valuation. So valuation and a bit more cyclicality in earnings, I think, is quite attractive.
Thank you. When you think about a quality company, does that not necessarily imply a shorter duration asset because there's more visibility? And therefore, that would be negative for those tech things, which are very long duration.
Well, I think, yeah, I think that's the question. So if you're basically the decision, it seems to me, for equity markets is how much you're going to build into anything that isn't those long dated super strong earnings delivery of the US tech sector. And you can either go for more cyclical businesses that have underperformed for obvious reasons. You can go for more defensive characteristics if the market changes its mind and starts to think of those longer term earnings as more uncertain. I think you just try and build a bit more of everything into it.
Thank you. And David, how's your equity allocation looking right now relative to previous times?
I would echo points that have been made already, actually. I'm firmly in the higher for longer camp. I think, you know, we've entered a period where structurally inflation is going to be higher, which would suggest if you look at historic periods of relatively high inflation, it would suggest that value as a style would outperform, you know, industrials, companies with hard assets, commodity related companies, and so on and so forth, and growth would underperform. And broadly, I fundamentally agree with that. You know, we've got heavy exposure to industrials and materials and energy and so on and so forth. But when we think about growth, what are we talking about these days? Because people, when you talk about growth, they immediately channel the US large cap tech stocks. These are not growth stocks. These are dominant monopolies. And you talked about pricing power. You know, pricing power in an inflation environment is tremendously important. So if you're, you know, think about, you know, if you're an online advertiser, who can you buy your advertising from? Two companies, dominant. You know, if you're a, you know, across all of these large cap tech areas, Salesforce, Meta, Google, Amazon, so on and so forth, they are dominant monopolies in their industry. So in an inflationary environment, they're set to do tremendously well. They're not really growth stocks. These are essentially mature monopolies. And mature monopolies are tremendous in an inflationary environment. So I wouldn't dismiss them. I would avoid, you know, earnings-free.
But is an advertising-led revenue stream quality? Surely that's deeply cyclical.
It's cyclical, but if you've got a monopoly, you've got tremendous pricing power. So, yes, we need to accept that they're cyclical. They've seen some ups and downs in their earnings, but the quality of their earnings, they're not going to lose their monopolistic position unless there's regulatory change.
I think that's really interesting, the way you've seen that this year, the way that they've smashed the broader US market out of the park. So small caps everywhere have come under a lot of pressure because they're more exposed to the funding environment that this inflationary world has created, which I think is going to be a very interesting dynamic.
And
across
the global
equity markets.
Made a mistake earlier this year. So if you look at the way, you know, everybody said inflation is here to stay, this, that, and the other, growth will underperform value. If you look at small caps, mid caps, growth has underperformed value. But in large caps, what we define as growth is essentially the big cap monopolies. They benefit from inflation. They're fine.
Thank you. Ben, if we start with you for the next one, what role can corporate bonds play in a defensive portfolio? I mean, if short-end govies are giving you 5, do you need to bother with the extra credit risk premium of corporate?
Well, I mean, we want to be greedy when we can be. You know, clients have, financial objectives.
Is that Invesco's new tagline?
Well, no, it's certainly not. Sorry. No, but like if there's more return on offer and it's worth the risk, then you go for it, even if it's, you know, a modest amount nominally. But I mean, that short dated corporate bonds look really interesting. I think the risk is, I think has been sort of articulated earlier, is that interest rates move higher and yields move a little bit higher. You know, short-term calls are a challenge, but, you know, high-quality businesses with lower default rate, even in a growth downturn environment, you know, where the spread above, sorry to get too technical here, but the sort of the spread above government bonds could move wider, those yields could still be dragged down by government bond yields moving lower. So I think there's a lot of environments where, you know, short-term dated corporate bonds look really interesting. And so, yeah, I mean, they're certainly a part of our model portfolios.
And the exposure you have, is that investment grade or do you go as far as high yield?
Well, it sort of depends where you are on the risk spectrum. I think if you're going down the lower risk spectrum, you actually have less equities in the portfolio. So there's a little bit more room to take corporate risk, and that suggests, you know, room for high yield. But of course, those lower risk clients also have a, you know, less tolerance for losses. So you just have to be careful. So it's investment grade is the short answer. But no doubt, like high yield is interesting. It's just in those lower risk portfolios where you'd like to, you know, work that yield that's available. The clients just are a little bit more resistant, and quite rightly, given their financial needs and goals, you know, to take that risk. But you know, if investment grade bonds do well, it's likely that high yield bonds are doing well as well.
Thank you. And Ian, how do you think about corporate bond exposure right now?
So down at the more risk-averse end of the spectrum, so we run risk profiles of strategies. Down at the lower end of the risk spectrum, we have an allocation to short-dated, you know, decent quality corporates, a bit of short-dated gilts as well, because we think those yields are attractive. And we offset that with a little bit of equity risk as well. And that's been generally our overall approach, you know, since launch. I do think I read something a couple of weeks ago though, which really challenged that, which was a piece by Howard Marks, who's just basically
basically choosing this moment to say this time is different, which is, you know, something that a lot of us are always very cautious about saying. But just saying that if you calling into question what a cautious investor is looking for. So if you think that you can get 9% yields on high yield bonds, admitting that you're straying into weak quality companies, but enjoying the fact you're higher up in the capital structure, why don't you just convert all of your portfolio into that one asset class? Because you are lending the money to someone else and expecting to receive it back through time and get enough of that money back, enough of that 9%, probably to meet the returns expectations of a cautious investor. The problem, of course, is that it doesn't take into account the time horizon that you're looking at. So the attractive part of short dated high quality corporates is that it's not just the quality, but you're going to get your money back a little bit sooner. And if then you can balance that with a bit more sort of upside from equities, then that to us still makes more sense.
Thank you, Ian. David, both Ian and Ben have referenced the yield available on corporate bonds right now, and those numbers nominally sound very, very nice, but if set against the prevailing inflation rate, I mean, it's positive real, but is it still worth owning corporate for that little bit of extra positive real yield?
Oh, I think so, very much so. And you know, echoing what's been said, the issue you have with your low-risk investor is he's sort of comparing you with cash. And from his point of view, path matters at least as much as destination. So I can sit here and say, look, you know, I can construct you a portfolio. I could use high yield and we can get, you know, very close to double digit, into double digit if we're prepared to swallow deep in high yield. And I can make the argument that over, you know, if you're buying very short dated high yield, your probability of default is very, very low as a general rule. But if I buy that asset, I know that, you know, as the market swings between higher inflation and recession and this, that and the other, I'm going to get near-term capital volatility. And that's what these low-risk clients don't like. So, you know, what I have to balance is I want to construct this portfolio for a client with a three-year view who wants to beat cash by it as much as is realistic. At the same time, he expects his journey to be very smooth. So I need these overall portfolios to come out with very low volatility. So Howard Marks's point is valid, but it's incorrect because he's not understanding the needs of the client. And the client has the common need of both beating inflation over time, but low volatility on the journey. That's where your short-dated corporates come in, because, you know, the spreads and rates are negatively correlated to some degree, you know, that equitiness of corporates. And so with very short-dated corporates, you do get the, you know, if you're in the investment grade at the top end, you're getting 200, 250 over at the moment. And that's a really nice return. Above 7, in a very low-risk asset with a duration of sub 3, balance that with a little bit of equities and real assets along the side, and you've got a very nice baked-in return at the moment. You don't need to swallow hard and go into high yield. Yeah, I mean, you could tickle a little bit in at the bottom of the portfolio, but why would you need it? I don't think you need it. If you want equity volatility, buy some low-risk equity.
Thank you for that, David. Jane, multi-asset investor at Premier Miton, and thank you to Ian Barnes, Chief Investment Officer at NetWealth, and Ben Guttridge, Director of the Model Portfolio Service at Invesco, for joining me today. And thank you all for listening. Please do remember to tune in to future editions of the FT Advisor podcast. Goodbye.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.